Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is currently Thursday, April 2nd. By the time you are hearing this, it will be Friday, April 3rd. My name is Rob Doster. I am here with the one and only Bobby Reagan, the host of the Fundamentally Sound Podcast, and we are bringing you another edition of the Run It Back Podcast. And for me, as a kid that grew up in the state of Connecticut with game, this review is going to be one of my favorite podcasts that we do all year. We are looking back at the 1999 NCAA tournament title game where number one seed UConn shocked the world and beat number one seed Duke in Tropicana Field in Tampa Bay. I'm very much looking forward to talking about this. For people that don't know, what we are doing is if you leave us a five-star review and you ask us to talk about a game, the most number of votes that we get for a specific game is going to be what we talk about on the next Run It Back
podcast. We're going to put it on Twitter. You need to specify, yes. Yeah.
Well, not just on Twitter. Like, what the most number of votes, what you get in the reviews.
Go to Twitter.
And if it ends up being a tie, then we have the vote right on Twitter to break the tie. This episode is we're recording because this broke the tie between the 2019 Purdue-Virginia Elite Eight game. And it was a landslide. Apparently UConn fans really want to hear us talk about this, Reeves.
I don't know what it is. Want to listen to people talk about UConn? I'm shocked.
It's shocking, right? Yeah, but anyway, so if you want to hear us talk about a game, review a game, we are doing these every Friday for the foreseeable future. This is just going to be our coronavirus thing, man. I love doing it. I love talking with you about these games. I love rewatching these old games.
Especially since we're the same age. So we're in the same mindset of when we're rewatching. Like, we're at the same stages of life. Like, it's not... You weren't, out drinking, celebrating at 21 years old watching this as a Connecticut fan. We're the same age. We were 12.
I'm pretty sure I got like a root beer float. Like, my big thing when I was 13 and 14 and 15 years old, I discovered Haagen-Dazs. And so, like, my big thing, like, whenever we would have like a special dessert or something, we would go out and we get like two of the little pints of Haagen-Dazs. So I'm like 90% sure the way I celebrated this was by drinking a soda and like eating a raspberry sorbet from Haagen-Dazs. Like, that was my shit when I was 14.
But I think that's why I like this. Outside of like rewatching games, and remember, we are doing just one game per each year's tournament until we kind of run through a good amount of them. But I like it because, like I said, we're the same age, so we were in the same mindset of watching all these games. So it's fun, It's like opposite of like talking to like our dad, where it's like, okay, like literally, my dad was literally at this game. So it's like, yeah, him and my uncle went to the Final Four.
Did you ask him? Did you ask him about it?
I didn't because I forgot.
Shocker! And, real shocker there that Reeks forgot to do something.
Yeah, you have to. Which reminds me, you have to tell me that you have to remind me at the end of this podcast to turn on the dryer because I told my wife I'm not going to let it go off during the podcast.
There's no way I'm going to remember.
You think I'm going to remember
it? There's no way. I can't even remember to turn on my own dryer, bro. Come on.
I can't use it's March anymore as an excuse.
You can't put this on me. You cannot put this pressure on me. I'm going to get blamed by your wife. She's going to hate us.
Probably.
You know what we should do? At some point, like when we just completely run dry of content in like 9 months and there's still the coronavirus and there's still no sports, we should just let our wives go on and let them talk about how horrible we are and all the shit that we forget to do.
So we do trivia for this. You ask me 5 questions. I asked my wife today, I said, can you name one team that played in the 99 title game? She got Duke. That was her first guess because she knew it wouldn't be Kentucky because it would have been too obvious. So she got that and I said, can you guess who they played? And she guessed like the obvious ones, Kansas and Florida right away. And then she goes, well, is it a team that's like, I would know that's pretty good? I was like, yeah. And she goes, Baylor. I was like, what? How did you go to Baylor from here? So I can only imagine what our wives, like, college hoops conversation would be like.
It would be very, very interesting. All right. So let's start by just kind of like setting up what the context of this game was. Yep. And I'm going to open the floor to you first and foremost to talk a little bit about Duke and who was on this team, how the season set up, why they were such an overwhelming favorite for this game. Talk to me a little bit about those the 1999 Duke Blue Devils.
So they were coming off a year, the year prior, where they lost in the Elite Eight. I forget what team they lost to, but they blew this big lead. And Steve Wojciechowski got bent in half, literally during the game. I believe it was Kentucky that beat them in the Elite Eight the year before. So they were coming off this year where they were obviously talented the year prior. Loaded roster. Trajan Langdon was a redshirt senior. Shane Battier was a sophomore. Elton Brand was a sophomore. William Avery was a sophomore. Nate James was a sophomore. Corey McGetty was a freshman. Chris Carroll was a junior. They also played Chris Burgess, who was a sophomore, 6'10". That was their rotation. I don't think I forgot anybody when I was listening to that. Obviously, deep team. Obviously, a talented team. You heard NBA names. Battier, Brand, Avery. Langdon had a cup of coffee there. McGetty. They were preseason number one in the country. Again, not shocking. They had one loss in the regular season. They entered the NCAA tournament, ACC champions, ACC tournament champions, 32-1. They lost to a Cincinnati team in the Great Alaska Shootout. And I actually really remember watching that game. It was midnight.
So do I. I specifically remember watching that game and seeing Duke lose.
And it was like Cincinnati had the cool uniform. Like that was like the peak Cincinnati uniforms.
I think everybody our age loved those Cincinnati teams. You know how everybody.
Well, I hated Cincinnati's teams, but the jerseys.
I love the teams. I love the teams. I hated them. Because I think they were Jordan brand at the time.
Yep, they were like the only Jordan brand.
And they were so mean. And then I feel like everybody our age either loved Cincinnati uniforms or loved the Cincinnati program. The generation, the same way the generation before us loved the Georgetown uniforms and the Georgetown program. I think it was the same kind of
thing. And because you had awesome colors, like Cincinnati, obviously, like the red and black, Bearcats, a unique nickname. They could shorten it, like the C logo. There's that picture of Tupac wearing the Cincinnati sweatshirt. But I remember watching that game. I distinctly remember that. And the big thing was it was Trajan Langdon going back home to Alaska and playing in the Great Alaskan Shootout. That's when the Great Alaskan Shootout was fun. And a really good tournament. So that's their only loss. Like I said, they won the ACC, tournament. They're coming off an Elite Eight loss the year prior. Not a shock that they were the consensus favorite. They were ranked number one in the country all but a few, about 2 months.
They were preseason number one, and it was the first 5 weeks of the season. Yeah. They were ranked number one. Then they lost to Cincinnati. UConn was number one for the next 10 weeks because they were the only team left in the country that was undefeated.
Right.
And then Duke, when UConn lost to, it was, I have it written down in my notes. I should know this off the top of my head.
UConn, they lost to Syracuse and Miami.
Yeah, they lost to Syracuse on February 1st. They ended up dropping to number two, and Duke went back to number one for the last 4 weeks of the regular season. So UConn, believe it or not,
6 weeks of the regular season.
They were actually the number one team for more weeks in the AP poll than Duke was, believe it or not.
We'll get into that later. I'm glad you brought that up then. But so then Duke obviously enters the NCAA tournament as the one seed, blow out Florida A&M, blow out Tulsa, had a Cinderella or a 12 seed Southwest Missouri State blow them out, blew out Temple in the Elite Eight, then they beat Michigan State by 6. In the Final Four leading into the UConn game.
Yeah, so UConn, like I mentioned, they were the preseason number two team in the country. And they went 34-2 on the year. They went 16-2 in the Big East. They won the Big East regular season title. They won the Big East tournament title. Obviously, they won the national title. They were number one team in the country for more weeks than Duke was. They were never ranked lower than second in the country in the AP poll until the last regular season poll when they fell all the way to fourth because they lost to number 16 Syracuse and they also lost to number 15 Miami, right? So they were never ranked outside of the top four at any week during the season. They went 34-2. They were the last team in the country that was undefeated. And the idea that like they were this scrappy upstart underdog in this tournament is just like, it's been completely blown out of proportion in the history of time. It's like this team was absolutely loaded.
It's blown out of proportion during the broadcast.
It was. But like, so here's the thing. It wasn't like, you kind of got to put it into context, because this Duke team was like, in that year, was considered one of the best teams in the history of college basketball. It was kind of like the way that we looked at
2015 Kentucky, Wisconsin. That's exactly what this says.
Yes. And it's that same kind of thing where everyone else in the country was really, really good, at least compared to the rest of the college basketball. Historically, they ranked pretty well with everyone else. Like Khalid El-Amin was an All-American. Rip Hamilton was a top 10 pick that played in the NBA for 15 years. Jake Voskal was a pro. You look at some of the other guys that were actually on that UConn team, and like Ricky Moore was a senior, a really, really good defender, right? You had, I'm blanking on his name now, Kevin Freeman, who was a guy who's actually recruited by Duke.
Yeah.
He was a guy that was like comparatively would have been somewhere around like a top 50, top 75, four-star prospect. Like it wasn't like UConn didn't have talent. It wasn't like they were a good team, but that Duke team with Elton Brand and Trajan Langdon and all of these guys, and I think there were four players that ended up getting drafted in the top 14 picks of the 1999 NBA draft. They were absolutely loaded. Everyone thought they were one of the best teams in college basketball history. They beat the shit out of everybody in the ACC. So that's why it kind of got all this hype. It had nothing to do with how good UConn was, right? And had everything to do with the team that they were playing, right? Like, we can sit here and say that Wisconsin team in 2015 was a very, very good team, and still say that it was like shocking and something that nobody expected to happen when Kentucky lost, right?
Well, I'm saying the way that in 20 years from now, we'll be talking about that Kentucky-Wisconsin game the same way we're talking about this UConn-Duke game. And it's crazy, listening to the broadcast with Nance and Packer, they're talking like UConn was a 16 seed. And it was, and I get it, like that Duke team was awesome. But we're talking about a UConn team that was never worse than fourth in the country.
Yes. It's funny. It's funny when you think about it in that context. But the other part of it, Reeves, and I don't know how many people outside of the state of Connecticut will realize this, but like at the time, like UConn does not have any basketball history before Jim Calhoun gets there.
Right.
Like he completely built that program from nothing. And like they weren't even really relevant until like 1990. And like they had the run to the Elite Eight, like the one with the Tate George shot.
Tate George.
At the time, in 1999, they had made 8 of the last 10 NCAA tournaments, and they had been to 3 Elite Eights, but they had never been to a Final Four. This was like the first period of any kind of sustained success for the UConn program.
Right.
And at the time, they had won 5 of the last 6 regular season titles. Like entering the tournament, including 99, they'd won 5 of 6 Big East regular season titles, 3 of 4 Big East tournament titles. They won both the regular season and the tournament title in the Big East in 1998. They did the same thing in 1999. So like, this was the peak of the UConn powers, but we look at it now and say, yes, UConn is like during that stretch of time, they were a powerhouse, but it's kind of like the comparison that I think is probably fair is it's kind of like Virginia right now, where it took us seeing Virginia winning a national title to be able to look back in hindsight and be like, okay, like this team is really, really, and this program is really, really good. Whereas at the time, it looked like they were kind of a flash in the pan that got hot. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Program-wise, it's definitely Virginia. Game-wise, I think it's the Kentucky-Wisconsin. Just the perfect comparison.
No, yeah. You're actually absolutely right about that. And the way that the narrative is going to end up playing out. But the point that I'm trying to make is it's not like
UConn. It wasn't
UConn the way that we know it right now.
No, that I get 100%.
But in terms of narratives for UConn, like at this point, there were a lot of people that were saying like Jim Calhoun can do all of the stuff. He can win games. He can win regular season titles. He can't win in March. Like he chokes. He's not going to be able to get it done. They had lost in the 95 Elite Eight and the 99, the 98 Elite Eight.
Yeah, he was Sean Miller.
In 96, they were the number one overall seed, and they lost to do you know who they lost to in 96 in the Sweet 16?
Is that the
number 5 seed?
Is that the Florida team?
It was an SEC team.
Mississippi State.
Yep. that game still triggers me a little bit, because that was the year that Ray Allen had hit that ridiculous shot in the Big East tournament title game against Allen Iverson.
Yep.
And I was like, this is destiny. There's no way UConn's not, like, my 11-year-old brain was like, there's no way that UConn's not winning the national title. Right. Like, lock it in. We got this. Team of destiny. And then they lost to fucking Mississippi State. That was quite tilting. But yeah, so the narrative here had everything to do with what the perception of UConn was compared to the perception of this Duke powerhouse, and everything to do with, like, Jim Calhoun can't get it done. Coach K is like this great coach, won back-to-back titles 7 years before. That was another interesting thing about this that I didn't quite realize. Like, in the mid-90s, there was a real doldrum for Duke basketball. Like, you had the Coach K, the year that his back got hurt, then they had a couple of losing seasons. Well, not losing seasons, but early losses in the NCAA tournament before they finally made it back. And this was the year that they finally made it back.
I was talking to this about this to somebody earlier today when I was watching the game. He actually brought up the 2015 title game too. Duke might have the biggest what ifs, where they could have easily lost 2010, 2015. And the conversation about Krzyzewski at that point would be so different. And it's crazy. Like, I was thinking about that watching this game, where what if he would have won this game? Then I did well. He could have very easily lost this title, this title, this title. And it's just one of those. And I know you can do it for a lot of coaches, but when you're talking about a guy who's listed as number one coach of all time, it's kind of crazy to think of the what ifs from a Krzyzewski Duke standpoint and just strictly the title game.
Yeah, I mean, you can also go the other way.
That's what happens. That's like maybe do it with this game, where it's like, if he got this too, what? How? Like, yeah. Imagine even more how people would think about Krzyzewski. And then we play devil's advocate and say, well, what if? Could you imagine if he lost 2010, 2015? Imagine Duke fans now, or if he only had one of them. Now, I think that's an interesting study, like an interesting point of Krzyzewski.
Yeah, and the thing about him is, like, he hasn't been as great of a regular season coach, right, especially in like the last probably 14 years, as people realize. Yeah. And he also hasn't been as good of a tournament coach as people realize. But there comes a point when you kind of have to say, this dude took over a program that didn't really have any history. He made it into like the single biggest brand probably in the sport in the country. And he's won titles in three different decades. Like, yep. At some point you kind of got to say, yeah, fluky things happen in one game tournaments, but like,
I know, it's just,
I don't, it's I just can't, crazy. I can't subscribe to that. I can't subscribe to that idea. Whoever said that is very clearly a Kentucky alum.
No, it's not, it wasn't even a Kentucky. He hates Kentucky. The guy I was talking to.
Riggs is like, yeah, you know what? It was actually me. I was talking to myself.
That's where we reached that stage.
Myself. All right, what are we doing next? So the way that the game played out was actually like really close throughout. Duke jumped out to an early lead. UConn came back Ricky Moore scored 13 points in a 10-minute stretch in the first half. They took a lead towards the end of the first half. Then, like, very end of the half, Trajan Langdon bangs in this 4-point play and 1-3. Duke heads into the break ahead. They come out. It looks like they're about to run away with the game early in the first half. And then, like, I don't know if you noticed this, and I had completely forgotten about this, but there was like this Shane Batty gets a cut in his elbow. Like, Duke is up 48-43. The crowd is absolutely like a partisan Duke crowd is getting really, really loud. And Shane Batty gets this cut in his elbow. And they initially think that it is, I believe it was Edmund Saunders. It was Kevin Freeman that was bleeding because he had blood on his jersey. So they stopped the game, they delay it, they send him over. They can't find a cut on Kevin Freeman. They wipe the blood off his jersey. And then Shane Battier has to go to the bench because they realize, like, oh, the guy that has the blood dripping all the way down his arm, maybe we should go take care of that. So they go and they get him bandaged up and get that blood stopped. And then Shane Battier has to go shoot free throws, misses a free throw, and then there's immediately a timeout that goes straight into a TV timeout. So, like, it ended up being, like, Duke looked like they were ready to blow the doors off of UConn. And then there was, like, an 8-minute delay. Like, literally, on the YouTube video that I was watching, it was 8 minutes from when they first noticed the blood until when they started playing again.
See, I watched a YouTube stream that didn't have any commercials. So, I was able to, like, I didn't notice the delay because of it.
Minutes. So, I wonder how much of an impact that played. But, immediately after they got back, UConn goes on a little 8-2 run takes the lead, and they never trail again. They never trail again. And then down the stretch, like it was, UConn would push out to six, Duke will come back, they push out to five, Duke will come back. The last few seconds were Trajan Legdon, off an offensive rebound, bangs a three to cut the lead to 73-72 with a minute left. Khalid El-Amin comes down, hits this like tough as hell floater over Shane Battier to put UConn up by three. Duke comes down. I forget who scored. Somebody scored to cut the lead to one. There's an air ball by UConn, but then Trajan Legdon comes down. He travels. Khalid El-Amin is fouled with 5 seconds left. He makes both free throws, and then Trajan Legdon again, down by three with 5 seconds left, tries to go coast to coast, loses the ball, travels something, turnover, UConn wins. Ricky Moore runs over to Jim Nance and screams in his microphone, "We shocked the world."
Yeah, we shocked the world.
And meanwhile, young Rob Doster in his living room is losing his absolute mind.
The I think the iconic image is when it's 73-72 after Langdon bangs at three and off the offensive rebound. When El-Amin hits that runner, floater, whatever you want to call it, it's not that he hit it with like 2 seconds left on the shot clock. It's that it's him and Elton Brand, two great – Elton Brand was baby fat at the time because he's only a sophomore, guarding another fat guy out on the perimeter. My favorite image of the entire thing was just two fat guys wearing 42, a guard and a center with the game on the line. It, like I paused it. I was like, this is a ridiculous image. But it's also perfect for 1999 college basketball.
Yeah, and so they get on. That's another thing that I noticed is that Duke like started doing the switching thing.
Yep.
Way before everybody else. Like they switched every single ball screen.
And UConn running a zone. Like I never think of UConn as a zone team.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like I guess I didn't forget about it, but like Jim Calhoun's 2-2-1 press was like a big thing. State of Connecticut at the time, like that's what every really good high school team was running like 2-2-1 presses.
I have notes down about the 2-2-1 because I got excited watching a 2-2-1 press. Like I understand why teams don't run stuff like that anymore, but God, I wish teams would just full out 2-2-1 press, 1-2-2 press. I love those.
Yeah, a good 2-2-1 press is a good college basketball thing. All right, so let's talk about some of the things that you love from this game. What were moments that you had forgotten about? Things that kind of went unnoticed for you, specific plays or players that you love. Like, just talk to me a little bit about some of the stuff that you love in this game.
So, my favorite thing was, everyone's going to talk about Khalid El-Amin's t-shirt. It's the Richard Hamilton, Ricky Moore, sleeves cut off jersey. That was just peak late 90s, early 2000s. And it just brought me back to such a simpler time. And I was like, it just reminded me of, like, playing basketball back in the day. Because everybody, you either were, and what's funny is, like, jerseys turned into that. Like, I don't know about you, but I remember in, like, the Pennsylvania area around, like, 01, 02, a lot of teams started wearing jerseys as if they were wearing, like, the cutoffs. And it's just a ridiculous look.
It got to that point where everyone wore the cutoff sleeves. Like, and it wasn't, like, cutoff
at
the shoulder. It was cutoff where the seam is.
Yep.
So, like, the seam would be gone. And then you wear that underneath the jersey, two sizes too big for you. So when you run, it looks like you're drag racing and have the parachute billowing behind you, especially on Rip Hamilton, who weighs 108 pounds soaking wet.
So the thing that I forgot about, and it was talked about really early in the broadcast, I want to say within the first 2-3 minutes, they broke down the dome or how Tropicana Field was set up and how UConn was going to have an advantage in the second half shooting at the end that was closed. So it was like an easier shooting angle or, for eyesight and everything like that. This was, I believe, what, the first or second Final Four in a dome setting?
But this was, the thing about it is it wasn't a football dome. It was a baseball Tropicana stadium.
Right. But I'm saying, like, even just in general, this was still a new thing, just not playing in a basketball arena. So I forgot that you actually had announcers breaking down what advantage you had shooting at what side of the court.
Yeah, it was really weird when they would do, the angle where it's under the basket and you're looking at the free throw shooter with the crowd in the background. It was weird that they would take that shot and you could see like the foul pole
in
the background of Tropicana Field. That's when I was like, oh, wow, like, this wasn't a football stadium.
I kept thinking it was St. Pete, like where they play like the SEC tournament and they've had a couple NCAA rounds there. I kept thinking it was that at first and I was like, wait a minute, no, it is. It is Tropicana.
Yeah, that was so that's something I noticed too. You know what else I had completely forgotten about until we started watching this game was Ricky Moore and William Avery were high school teammates. I feel like that's the kind of thing that got as beaten to death as Nate Britt and Chris Jenkins.
That's
like,
the exact note I've written down. My note is William Avery and Ricky Moore were just the original Nate Britt and Chris Jenkins without living together.
Yeah, pretty much.
And it also led to the worst line in the history of commentating. Billy Packer, after Ricky Moore hit a jumper, he goes, at the 11-12 mark, he goes, Augusta, Georgia being put, or Ricky Moore from Augusta, Georgia, putting on a master's show. Wow, and then he looked at Nance and goes, I'm stealing one of yours. You like that? And Nance was like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, that was bad. That was bad. It was funny though. When they kept mentioning like literally the first thing I thought of was like, oh yeah, I remember that was a thing. And then the second thing I thought of was, I bet every single media member covering that story hated that storyline by the time it came out.
That's when, like, I think we have to like reach out to like ask like DeCourcy or someone that's been around forever, been like, all right, 99, yeah, what was the storyline?
There's a 100% chance that DeCourcy has a story about that. Probably. Like that dude has a story about literally everything.
I know. That's what I'm saying.
Like, by the way,
he's the one that I think we have to reach out to.
This is completely off topic, but if you watch the 92 title game and you look in the background and look at the media section, you can see DeCourcy there, and I swear to God, he looked exactly like John Krasinski. If John Krasinski was playing an early 90s sports writer, it cracks me up. Shout out to Mike DeCourcy. He might be the nicest human being in college basketball media. So one thing I didn't realize was, did you know that like Trajan Langdon went there and he wasn't on scholarship? Like, he was a professional baseball player.
Yeah, I forget a lot about Trajan Langdon, except for he's from Alaska.
Like, obviously, yeah, because he was the Alaskan assassin. Right. But I had no idea that he wasn't a scholarship player. Like, when Jim Nance said that, I was like, wait, what? Because he played baseball. He was, like, drafted and played professional baseball.
So did you know that? No.
He wasn't on scholarship there.
How?
Like, that threw me off.
So he was allowed to play collegiate basketball. He just couldn't be on scholarship.
That's literally what Nance said when he said the line.
That smells like an NCAA investigation.
Well, he was. I mean, it's happened before.
Russell Wilson, it just reminds me of like Bodie Miller having to sit out or whatever. What was that? Bodie with the Colorado punt returner. That was a not Bodie Miller, but whatever his name was. I had no idea Trajan Langdon played baseball.
Yeah, he was a sixth round pick of the Padres in the 1994 Major League Draft.
What position did he play?
He was I don't know. Doesn't say on his Wikipedia page. That's as much research as I.
He had to be a pitcher.
I'm willing to do.
He had to be a pitcher.
Yeah, maybe he's 6'4", maybe a first baseman.
Yeah,
he definitely looks like a pitcher though.
He's too lanky to be a first baseman.
Yeah. The other thing that this other story that I had completely forgotten about was, like, you know, Chris Burgess deal, right?
Somebody had a long piece on him earlier this year. Yeah.
Brendan Quinn, obviously, was
Brendan had Quinn. It.
Annoying. It's annoying how good he is.
He's too good.
Yeah, he's not fair. So some of the other things, like a lot of the stuff that just threw me back to a completely different era. Like, first and foremost, Kevin Freeman was wearing my absolute favorite pair of Jordans. My favorite one ever. I believe it's the Jordan 14s. And it was the all-white ones that had the do you know what the Jordan 14s were?
Yeah, I'm shocked.
It was the one that looked like they had the teeth. Whatever it was, like, the reason it's my favorite is because I just remember, like, that was the age when I kind of first really started getting into shoes.
Right.
And, like, that's when that edition of the Jordans – like, was big, and it was it was the Jordan 14 oxidized green is the one that he had on. So it was like the little teeth part of it were black and everything else on the shoe was white. And I think that was the era where you wore baggy shorts and you wore socks that you couldn't see over the top of the shoe. And I was like, I just remember when I was like 14 years old, like, that was the look. That right there was the look that everybody had to have. And I remember looking at that, and it just threw, like, all those shoes just threw me back to the days of sitting there and, like, just thumbing through East Bay Magazine, circling the shoes that I love, being like, oh, those are the ones. Those are the ones. Those are the ones.
Those in the team basketball shorts I wanted to get for Christmas or my birthday.
Yes. Yes. 100%. Also, this probably doesn't apply to you, but UConn shorts
were phenomenal.
The 99 shorts were absolutely my favorite pair of shorts ever. I still have like two pairs of them.
I would say I had a
blue
pair of
one and
up.
A white one.
I love getting team shorts. My all-time favorite. I guarantee you can't guess my favorite college basketball team shorts. It's a major team. They won a title in our lifetime.
Major team that won a title in our lifetime.
And it's not Kentucky.
Is it the Louisville old school ones?
No, it's the 97 Arizona. I loved. I had them blue, red, white. I loved the Arizona shorts. I almost wanted to go to college here strictly because of them.
I know exactly the ones that you are talking about.
Yes.
The other thing that really threw me off that I started cracking up at was whenever they would have the graphics that got put up, it would be like the CBS Sportsline stat of the day, AOL keyword, CBS Sportsline. What the fuck is an AOL keyword?
What I had written down, what brought me back, was just how shitty the scoreboard was. No timeouts, no fouls. You didn't know who had possession. It was literally just in your bottom right corner. And sometimes it wouldn't even come up for like a minute.
I loved that though. I kind of love that.
I'm spoiled now. I'm used to like the entire bottom of my screen with the score, timeouts left, foul, and possessions. I was put back into a time where I was like, okay, wait a minute. How much time was left? Okay, yeah. Okay, how many timeouts are left? Okay, they're in the bonus. I can't imagine living like that again.
Yeah. Yeah. It really threw me off. But the part of it that kind of frustrated me was that it wasn't in HD, right? And like, first and foremost, like how did we function without HD TV? And second of all, it wasn't widescreen.
No.
So like, not only did you have like, it was just like this box
with
so much space on the bottom, but like there was so much room for you to be able to just put whatever kind of graphic you wanted. Because nowadays we're watching on these huge widescreen flat screens that take up like a quarter of the bottom of the screen with your score graphic.
It was,
and they're able to make it work.
It was wild to see just how we used to watch TV.
Yeah.
And that was a nightly basis.
Yeah. Anyway, so the Chris Burgess thing, for people that don't know, like he was like the number one recruit. Like he was supposed to be like the next Christian Laettner, the next big thing, this guy that was supposed to be the next big star. And he spent 2 years like riding the bench at Duke and ended up transferring out and was kind of viewed as like a massive bust. Mm-hmm. Like maybe I'm trying to like, what would be a good comparison for him? Like maybe like a Scalabissier
kind Bernardo of Bernardo Sidney.
Yeah, but no, see, he didn't have the off the court issues. He just ended up not being as good.
Scal, maybe. I'm trying to think if there's someone who, you know, who's a good one. I can't think of his name. He went from Villanova and then he went to USC, white guy.
Taylor King.
Yes.
But see, Taylor King also had some.
I know. I'm just trying to think of somebody who stayed, because like Scal is just 1 year than now. So I'm trying to think of somebody that was in college longer than 1 year.
Whoever it is, someone like people on, just tweet us and let us know what you think. But he was just a guy that was supposed to be like this unbelievable player, this unbelievable prospect. And it just did not work for him at Duke. He ended up transferring out, finished his career elsewhere. And I did not realize he was on that team. I remember the Chris Burgess story, but I for some reason, I thought he was like a decade earlier. I thought he was like the 91, 92, like on that Christian Laettner team.
He played a decent amount of minutes too.
He did not very well.
No, but I'm saying like he was out on the floor more than I expected, because I remember reading Brendan's story about it, but I was like, okay, he's going to play 2 minutes, right? Like he comes in at the end of the half or, when coaches do the, okay, we're going to take somebody out with the 30 seconds before TV timeout. He was out. He probably played like 12 minutes that game.
Yeah, he did. He was out there. So there's a couple other things that I have written down. First and foremost, like I wrote, Ricky Moore was the first Spike Albrecht. just completely popped off for the first half out of nowhere. I know it's not exactly the same, but
you know who my comparison would be for him is the NBA, like Pat Beverly. That's what he kind of reminded me of.
Yeah, he just went off. And that, I specifically remember like that entire season, Ricky Moore was never a threat. Because the other thing I didn't realize was that Khalid Amin made some big shots on the stretch, but he played like shit.
Yeah, he missed. He did not have a good free throw shooting day. He did not shoot the ball well. Like he was
turnovers, fouls. Yeah. Jim Calhoun didn't play anyone with two fouls. I completely forgot about that. Well, I didn't forget about it, but I didn't realize that it happened in this game as well. Because Khalid Al-Amin did not play the final 10 minutes of the first half. And then he sat for another 5 minutes when he picked up his third foul 2 minutes into the second half.
Crazy.
It's amazing that Jim Calhoun could be such a great college basketball coach while doing so many dumb things.
I know.
Other things that I had, I had written down.
I forgot how fat Jake Voskal was.
Yeah, he was. We'll get onto that in a little bit. We got to save that. There was a point too where they were talking about. So Kevin Freeman, when he was in high school, he was from, I believe, he was from Massachusetts, and then he transferred to Patterson Catholic in New Jersey, and he played his senior season on the same high school team as Tim Thomas, who was the number one prospect. Ended up going to Villanova. Ended up being a one and done. And they got Billy Packer and Jim Nance got into a conversation about this. And one of the things that Packer said was, it was Jim Nance that said it. He was like, you have to rethink the way that you recruit because Tim Thomas played 1 year at Villanova. Yep. And 3 years later, Kevin Freeman is playing a role player on a UConn team that was playing in the national title. I thought that was pretty funny. Like 21 years later, when one and dones have really become a thing, we are still having that exact same conversation.
It just shows like people just won't change because the conversations are the same way. Most people our age are like, whatever. Older people still like you can't win. Like you have to win with a big guy in the post, and you have to do this. And it's like, no, you win by like just getting the best players, having good chemistry, and maybe hitting some threes.
Yeah, and the funny part to me about it was like that Duke team was so young. JJ Langdon was a 5th-year senior, but Elton Brand was the national player of the year, and he was a sophomore.
Shane Batty is a sophomore.
Corey Maggette was a freshman coming off of the Duke had a one and done on their roster and they made it to the title game.
Nate James sophomore. Like they were that's even going back to what we said at the beginning. It perfect why this is 2015 Wisconsin Kentucky.
Yeah, and it really built up for the 2000, 2001, 2002 Duke teams were some of the best teams that like we've ever seen.
I mean, they had arguably the best college player that I've seen him like in my lifetime.
Jason Williams?
Yes.
Yeah, he was.
He's
he was
like, so if good, he's man. Not the best, he's in the conversation for it.
Where does, what happens if Jason Williams never gets a motorcycle? Where does that it's rank for you in terms of like all time greatest basketball what ifs?
It's probably in the back end of the top 10.
Yeah, I think he would have been. I don't know if he ever would have been like Hall of Fame good. I don't even know if he would have been like first team all NBA good.
But
you'll never convince me that he doesn't become like basically a Brad Beal kind of a player.
Yeah, like he makes some
Ben Gordon in his prime.
Yeah, makes some all-star games, gets onto a couple all NBA teams, is always in that conversation of is he an all NBA player or is he not?
Averages like 24-4 for his entire career.
And
like
it's maybe, Chicago. Could you imagine like
you know what? Derek like maybe Rose Kyrie Irving. Maybe Kyrie Irving is a good comparison for what he could have been.
Yeah. But could you imagine if him and Derrick Rose played together?
Oh, that would have been so much fun. There wouldn't have been enough shots to go around, but that would have been a lot of fun.
I know.
That would have been a lot of fun. You got anything else before we get into the segment stuff?
No, we can get into the segment stuff. I think we kind of had the same notes.
Yep. All right.
Actually, the only thing I would do want to say is the outrageous stat, two outrageous stats that were said from the Duke side. When it was 12-11 UConn, that was the first time Duke trailed in 78 minutes in the NCAA tournament. The second one was when UConn took the lead 62-57. That was the largest deficit of the season for Duke.
Was it really?
That's what they said on the broadcast.
Wow.
I mean, I have a hard incredible. Time believing that, but apparently.
UConn led by 6 at one point in that game, too. It was 65-59
Yeah, so they said it right before then, because it was 62-57 when Nance said
it. Yeah, so there's two other things. Like, UConn fans will appreciate this. There was one point when they were like, it doesn't matter if Rip Hamilton goes pro, because they panned this kid on the bench. They got this kid, Azu Day, who is going to be the next superstar. And, like, anybody with even a moderate understanding of, like, late 90s, early 2000s UConn basketball will laugh hysterically at that. Azu Day, like, Reeves, I kid you not. Azu Dang got hyped up like he was literally Michael Jordan in his prime joining the UConn basketball team, and he was just like, whatever.
The best is his expression on the bench. You could tell he was even like, whatever, just sitting there. He's like, what am I doing here?
Yeah, it was. Like, I wish I could explain to you the level of hype that kid had in the state of Connecticut at the time. Like, this was before Twitter, before the internet, before everything. It was just word of mouth. And I specifically remember like having conversations with my friends, being like, who cares? Let Rip Hamilton go pro. We got Azu Dang, baby. We got nothing to worry about. Azu Dang.
How weird was it watching Rip Hamilton play without a mask on again?
It was a little bit weird. It was a little bit weird, but it was so, like, I forgot how much I missed just seeing him run in circles.
Yeah.
Here's another thing that UConn did. The sets that they ran where they would run Rip Hamilton off of the Iverson cut and then not give the ball to him and have him run off of double screens the other way. So he basically just runs in big circles off of four total screens to try to get a shot on the opposite wing. Like, that was, we ran that in high school. That they ran that for me a couple times in high school. Like, everybody in the state ran that. It was like 2-2-1 presses, Iverson cuts, double screens, down screens, find a shooter that could run all day and just get shots up.
Yep.
And fat point guards too. Like, there were a lot of white kids and a lot of fat white point guards that thought that they could be the next Khalid El-Amin. It was the worst thing that ever happened to Connecticut high school basketball. That's absolutely not true. All right. So let's start with this. One of the things that we want to do, one of the segments that we love to do for this is the one shining moment and the one shitty moment. So first things first, what was your one shining moment, Reeks?
I'm debating on which one I want to go with here. Because
You know what? Let's start with the defining moment of the game. Because normally we do that last, but I want to do the defining moment first because I think it's very obvious what that is. And it is Khalid El-Amin running to the scorer's table and screaming, "We shocked the world," loud enough that everybody on the broadcast could hear it. Like, that was that. I don't know how that, I actually am curious, like, because how does it stand out for you? Because for me, growing up in the state, like, that was such an unbelievable thing to hear, because it was this guy that we all love, this guy that was an underdog coming out of high school, this guy that is too short and too fat to be able to win a national title coming in here and saying the same thing that, like, all of us as fans believed. And to me, like, that stands out more than anything. And I mentioned this before. I think it was – I don't remember what podcast it was on. But there's also a picture that ended up being on the – I think it was the front page of the New Haven Register the next day of, like, as soon as he ran by there, it was Khalid El-Amin getting hugged by Rashamel Jones with his jersey getting pulled, like, screaming at the top of his lungs immediately afterwards. And to me, like, more than anything else in that game, that's what stands out.
Yeah, so I tried to go outside of the box because there are a lot of obvious ones. The defining play to me, though, was at the 5:45 mark, at 65-64 UConn, Jake Voskal blocks Elton Brand and then just shoves him to the ground, and they don't call a foul. And at that point, it felt like UConn is here because the crowd kind of got into it. There was the missed foul call. Billy Packer lost his mind about the missed foul call. And it was almost like, we don't care that you're Duke and that you're supposed to beat us. Like, that was the moment I felt like rewatching it, knowing the outcome. With a one-point game, 5:45. Like, Brand just dunks that ball. I think Duke maybe goes on and wins it because it felt like Voskal set a tone almost. Like, we're not going away this last – like, you can't just bully us this last 6 minutes.
No, you're 100% correct about that. That's one of the things that I have written down too. The other one is it was UConn had – the Duke had come all the way back and tied the game at 66. UConn had managed to find a way to get ahead. They were up 69-67 after Duke had come back to tie the game. And at one end of the floor, they were able to get a stop. I believe it was William Avery starts dribbling out of control, against the 2-2-1 press, turns the ball over. Ricky Moore gets the ball. They push it the other direction. He gets back out to Khalid El-Amin. Rip Hamilton runs off of one of those Iverson cuts. Duke switches. Elton Brand dives for a loose ball or dives for the steal. Doesn't get it the same way that Daniel O'Sheff would go for the ball when he was trying to get the steal from Ryan Arcidiacono, from Marcus Page. And Rip Hamilton buries the three. And Jim Nance, he said, he rips the long one, which I just fucking loved. Even though that was so corny and like so on brand for Nance, I loved it. Anything like if it's something for UConn, I absolutely loved it.
Oh, if most of the time, if it's Nance being corny, I'm here for that because that's Nance. Like, I want that out of Nance. It's when it's the other guys doing it. When we made fun of like Grant Hill doing it, Billy Packer, Nance doing it, that's Nance. It's like somebody stealing onions from Raft. You can't do that. You can't be corny around Nance either.
No, you cannot. You cannot. Yeah, so that was the one shining moment for me. And I agree with you on, like, the Vosko thing. Like, that play really stood out
to me. That's a defining play to me. And there's obviously the one shining moment, I think, is Khalid El-Amin hitting the runner, honestly.
Yeah.
Because it's, again, like, it was 4 seconds left in the shot clock when he, I guess, technically released it. But the fact that it was Calhoun basically said, win this for us, Khalid. Like, he just put the ball in his hands. It wasn't out of a timeout. It was it was just a ball screen. It's a high ball screen.
And switched, and then he just goes left on
he takes a second, sizes him up, big boy ball, literally, and goes to the baseline. And that's the shining moment for me, because that was, like you said, obviously if you're a UConn fan, you know the Khalid El-Amin story. You know UConn on the map story. And it was kind of perfect in a way that Jim Calhoun just said, I'm going to win or lose with this guy. Go make a play. And I kind of love when coaches do that.
The reason we love that, too, is because Rip Hamilton was a guy that was going to be a pro no matter what.
Yeah.
Right. And Jake Voskal, 7-footer in that day and age, like, you got a really good chance of making the NBA.
Right.
And, Khalid El-Amin was this guy that was a little too short that no one really paid attention to, and a little too small. No one really respected him or respected anything that he could do. And when it comes down to like college basketball, like that's what people view Connecticut as, like,
right?
Too small. No need
middle
to respect
of nowhere.
Him. Middle of nowhere. So like Khalid really, the state really, really embraced him.
Yep.
And like specifically, I really, really embraced him. And like, I love that dude. He's my second favorite UConn player of all. Like, Ray Allen is my number one because
he's Ray Allen.
Yeah. Like he was the first guy that I ever loved his basketball. Like, I was 8 years old when he got there. So like when I'm first starting to fall in love with the sport, the guy who is the best player on the team is Ray Allen.
Right.
So like there's you have to. Like, I feel like I'm legally obligated to say Ray Allen is my favorite player, right?
You have to if you're a UConn fan.
I don't really have a choice. So, but Khalid is the guy that the state really identified with, right, as much as anyone else. And then if you look over the years, like, look at the guys that Kemba Walker is like 5'9" and won a national title for us. And Shabazz Napier is a guy that, like, his attitude, his swagger, the way that he would say whatever the hell he wanted. Like, my favorite Shabazz Napier story is, do you remember in 2012, like, this is completely off topic, but in 2012, it was the year after they won the title, and Napier was a sophomore. They had Alex Oriaki back. Jeremy Lamb was coming back as a sophomore. They were a preseason top three team, and then Andre Drummond committed in late August. And they went from being this team that everyone was like, okay, yeah, they should be really good, to like, yo, this team like could legitimately go out and win back to back. Like, this is probably the best opportunity anybody's had to go back to back since Florida in 2007. Like, that's what the narrative was. And they were bad. Like, they stunk.
Yeah.
They ended up being like a 9 seed. They went 8-10 in the Big East. They were bad. And after they got knocked out of the first round of the NCAA tournament by Iowa State, was the 8 seed, UConn was a 9 seed. And in the locker room after that game, guys are just sitting there laughing and whatever. And Shabazz Napier turns around and full on throws a haymaker and punches the locker. I have no idea how he didn't break his hand, but he punched the locker. And he was just like, F this, like, fuck these guys. Like, nobody cares about this shit. Like, I care about it. And to me, that kind of summed up what he was for that team and that program and that state, and like why he ended up being a guy that could carry a team
right
to a national title and get to the NBA and play a while, be a first round pick. So, all right. So what was your one shitty moment? I think this is pretty obvious.
Yeah. I was listening to Billy Packer talk about how awesome it was. Duke was at taking charges.
Oh my God.
It's the worst. I don't like Billy Packer. Like, he's the worst.
I don't understand what he does well. What does he do well?
Well, I've told you before, my dad went to Wake Forest. Billy Packer, like, my dad was there when Billy Packer tried to get the job, and he kind of turned on Wake Forest. Wake Forest turned on him. So my whole life, I heard from my old pop, my old man, like, Billy Packer's just an asshole. We hate Billy Packer. We hate Duke. Listening to Billy Packer get way too excited about Duke charges while he was there was one call where it was a block. He's like, well, I don't know. Trajan Langdon might have been there. I'm like, just stop talking right now because I'm going to throw my remote.
There were three things that really pissed me off about Billy Packer watching this game. One is like, they're not calling charges. Yep. The players have to adjust. Like, he started saying that 3 minutes into the game.
Yep. It's the worst.
It was 3 minutes into the game. He's like, they're not calling charges. The players have to adjust. And the first time he said it, I swear to God, the first time he said it, the very, like, that possession, someone got called for a charge. Yep. It was just kind of like, well, there's a charge. Like, so shut the fuck up, Billy Packer.
I have four Billy Packer notes that just drove me insane.
There was another one where he goes, Edmund Saunders stole the ball from Elton Brand at one point, and Sulaiman Juan like laid the ball back in, and Billy Packer goes, when you strip the ball from the guy with the largest hands in college basketball, you've done something. Thanks, Billy. Thanks for that. The other part that just drove me absolutely insane and like literally made me want to hit mute watching the broadcast was when UConn made a little bit of a run and he's like, these guys are tired. Yep. They're tired. Duke needs a timeout. Why? I'm shocked that Duke won't call a timeout. I'm shocked he hasn't called a timeout. Why aren't they calling a timeout? He needs to call a timeout. It went on this like for like 3 minutes and then UConn pushed the lead to six while he's going on this rant. And then Duke immediately came back and tied the game. It went from 65 to 59 to 66 to 66 in the span of like 2 minutes. They weren't tired.
It was a 10-minute mark. I have that note because he was losing his mind going, Duke ran out of stamina. I'm like, we're 30 minutes into the game. What do you mean they ran out of stamina? This isn't a plucky underdog with like the under four coming up. So my other Billy Packer notes was the taking charge was my least favorite one. When he lost his mind when towards the end of the game, Nance, they showed Gamble Pavilion and Nance was like, they're going to be in for like a party tonight. And Billy Packer's like, as long as it's not like what they did in East Lansing and Michigan State, we can't have that. And then when Duke tied it up, Duke slapped the floor and Billy Packer got very excited. And he's like, Duke's back to their old ways. Look at them slapping the floor.
Yeah, I saw that. Their old ways. Wojo like left the program in what, 98? It was like literally the year before.
Yeah, the year before.
Oh God, that was I'm so glad that he's not there. Ugh. So happy he's not there. I'm not. Grant Hill is fine, but the fact that it's like Bill Raftery in the Final Four in the title game is like the best thing in the world. I swear to God, dude. Like if they just put Gus Johnson and Bill Raftery on every single game for the rest of college basketball history, I would not. I don't care how old they are.
It would make
Bill
up Raftery for this year.
Is like 105. Yeah. Gus Johnson's like 68 at this point. They're probably younger.
I will say Nance does have the big game voice. So I'm cool with Nance and Raftery. But the biggest upgrade in literally the history of the world was going from Billy Packer to Bill Raftery.
Yeah. Yeah. That is 100% true. Nance, his call at the final was I hate it. But I also hate that I love it. he goes, folks. You got to believe, because when people say you can't,
UConn.
You can. And UConn has won the national championship.
Yeah,
God, that's so bad, but it's so perfect.
So what's your one shitty moment? Because we obviously went into the tangent with Billy Packer with mine.
I mean, it was Langdon's travel.
Okay, yeah.
It was when they were down by one with the ball on what should have been the final possession, and what they decided to do was have Trajan Langdon go one-on-one off the dribble against Ricky Moore. Like, I love Trajan Langdon. I think he's very good. He was an All-American for a reason, right? But, like, having him go off the bounce one-on-one to try to get you a shot to win a game is, like, That cannot be the optimal play.
No, and let's be honest.
That cannot, like, especially when Ricky Moore is guarding it.
Langdon's a shooter. Like, he's not somebody, yes. His game wasn't, he could take somebody off the dribble and things like that, but when you look at that roster, put the ball in McGetty's hand, Avery's hand. Well, try to get a Delton Brand in the post.
Yeah, whatever. There's a million different things you can do. I just like anything there's no like that. Way that having Langdon go one and one off the dribble is the optimal play.
And I'm cool with Krzyzewski not calling a timeout there. Like I'm not.
I loved it. Like right. That's fine. Like when you have a team that's that talented and that old, like you should be okay with it. It's just that can't be the best thing that you can get.
I know.
It just can't be.
I know.
Can't be. All right. So, what were the things that you loved for no reason, and what were the things that you hated? Let's do the things you loved that you didn't realize you were going to love for no reason.
I mean, obviously, Khalid El-Amin was just like
we shouldn't even have to mention. You guys know we love Khalid. This is a Khalid El-Amin podcast.
I actually loved a Duke player. Can you guess which one?
Which Duke player you loved?
Yep.
I mean, honestly. I really do kind of feel like Chris Kellerwell is like your kind of a player.
No, I loved William Avery because he's the first one that exposed Kay for being kind of an asshole where he left for the NBA and Krzyzewski, report came out. So shout out William Avery. I forgot how much I loved him for that as a notorious Duke hater. So
I thought you were just talking about like, okay, I got you. I see where you're going.
If there was one Duke player I would like on that team, it'd be Corey Maggette, strictly because of the NBA.
Yeah.
The things I loved, I saved this for Nance Ty, but I'll bring it up now. I love the Final Four logo.
Yeah, it was really good.
It was just a solid, like, it's on half, right on midcourt. I just love the old NCAA tournament setup. Like, the banner that ran along in between the benches that had the four teams, like, listed at the site that were playing, and then it, like, would eliminate to the two. It had the ear. It's just a beautiful visual. And it just reminded me of growing up watching the tournament. Even now, like going back to seeing that, I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember that.
All right. So you're 100% right about that, by the way. So the two things that I really love that I did not realize until rewatching this this broadcast, first and foremost, was did you know that they flipped a coin to see who would be the home team and who got to wear the legs?
I have that. I had that as a note. Yeah.
I did not realize that was a thing. That's awesome.
I'll save my spoiler alert for later, but I love that it went to a coin flip.
The other thing that I loved was at the end, nobody was celebrating that victory harder than Khalid El-Amin. I don't know if you noticed, but like every time they cut to him, he had another, like, so he comes over and he says like, we shocked the world. And then he's in front of immediately gets in front of the camera, like popping the jersey, doing all that. And then like 10 seconds later, they cut to him and he has a shirt on and he runs towards the camera and looks at the camera and goes, no, I got it. And then they cut away from him and he runs the other direction and you never see him again. And the next time you see him, he's running towards the fan base and he's got a ball under his arm and the hat pulled, like the flat brim pulled down, like to the side real tight, like pounded his chest, like pointed at the fans. God, I love that dude so much. Like I guarantee if there was ever a party that I ever wanted to go to, it's whatever party Khalid El-Amin was at after that game.
Yeah. I can't imagine. I can't imagine what he got into.
I love that dude so much. I got to get him on the podcast at some point. I was supposed to last year, and it just kind of like we couldn't find a way to get the schedules to work up. But I have to get him back on because I have to ask him about celebrating after that game and what he did. So that was the two things that I love. What did you hate?
Shane Battier.
Random things you hated.
Shane Battier. Like I always respected Shane Battier for how good he was. I can't stand watching the dude play.
You know what they said on the broadcast that he went and he interned at Merrill Lynch before he got to high school or to college, and that he hated Duke. But then when they started recruiting him, he was like, "Yeah, you know what? I'm trying to get on this winning team."
Yeah, he loved Michigan, loved the Fab Five, and all that. He said he hated everybody, but thought Grant Hill was okay, which kind of made me laugh. I hated that. I just hated Shane Battier.
Yeah, you know what though? Like I actually like kind of loved Shane Battier because he's like nobody ever leaned into the idea of being like the Duke villain. Let me put it like this. I don't think that you can have the stereotypical Duke guy more than Shane Battier in terms of like super smart, successful. Loves to take charges, hits a bunch of threes, like a complete and total nerd anytime you talk to him. And like just happens to be probably the best basketball player that you're ever going to play against when you play against them. So I kind of loved, I hated him, but I loved the fact that he leaned into this idea that he was going to be as hateable as you can possibly be while being a Duke. Does that make sense?
I get it.
Like I love the fact that he just leaned into it, even though I hated everything that he represented.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I get it. I just can't stand watching the dude play because of the charges.
Fair enough. He was so good at it. Like, he was so good at selling
flops. He was.
And you know what? You know what the other thing that stood out to me was, like, how everything – like, there would be charges where you would step underneath a guy as he was landing directly under the basket, and it would be called a charge. And I was like, thank God they put in the charge. Like, the charges suck now, but they were even worse back then.
I know. It's crazy to look at, like, the old court. Like, I mentioned just the banner on the side, but like no restricted arc area, the 3-point, like there's not 6 3-point lines out there. The court is even just different. What'd you hate?
So it was Jake Voskal's hair and sideburns combo. Like nobody has ever represented like late 90s, early 2000s, Texas white trash more than like Jake Voskal's hairdo with the sideburns and like the fade up on the back and the hair slicked back, but not all of it slicked back, only the middle slicked back with the sides like coming down, over, like circling the side of his face. For people that aren't picturing this, like the guy that he reminded me of is, did you see True Detective season 1?
Oh yeah.
You know the revivalist pastor that they go and they meet that's like preaching in tents, and then they go and they meet up with him again, and he's like living in a shed on a dock. You know that guy that I'm talking about, and he turned into a drunk. Like that's the guy. Like that was his hairdo. That's who Jake Voskal was representing in that moment. And I was just kind of like, I can't believe that I love Jake Voskal with that hairdo.
You know who he looked like? Every Disney movie villain. Like the Eric Von Docker, whatever the guy's name was, from Brink.
Yes.
Like, that's what he looked like. Just like the, because he had the bright blonde hair. He did have it, like, partially slicked back. He had the cool name. Like, Jake Voskal. So that's a cool name. So he's a good name. He looked like a Disney Channel villain. Just a monster version of it.
Yeah. So that's all I got for things that I hated.
Here's my hot take of what I hated. Not just Billy Packer. I thought the broadcast did not do the game justice. I almost fell asleep watching the game today.
I almost did too, but that's also because like I am.
I know I'm so just exhausted too.
I'm so tired.
I watched it at like 1 o'clock, but I thought I didn't think Nance was on his game. Obviously Billy Packer, for how great of a game that is, it loses a little bit of luster to me watching it, listening to the commentary.
Yeah, like you need that excitable voice. Like the great thing about Packer, or I'm sorry, not Packer. The great thing about Raftery is you get nothing out of it. Like if you're watching it in order to get X's and O's analysis, if you're watching it to try to learn something about the game of basketball, like you're not getting that from Bill Raftery. What you're getting is watching a game with a dude that is going to be just as excited as you are when something crazy happens.
But it's not
you
even
know, we talked about this with Gus Johnson, like the same thing with him. When you watch a game being called by Gus Johnson, it feels like you're watching a game with your buddy at a bar who's invested in the game and losing his shit over everything that happens the same way that you are. Like he just happens to have a feathery voice and great timing.
But so you know? There are examples where Nance without Raftery has been awesome. Like Nance and Greg Anthony. And it's like, okay, that because Nance was on his game. For whatever reason, Nance just seemed off this game too. And it just made for where I just like, I don't want to watch this game again. And I don't know if that's like it's just my hot take where it loses its luster and the sense of rewatchability because you can't rewatch it with sound.
Yeah, no, I get it. I get it. I hear what you're saying. There's two other random moments that I wanted to bring up. They showed
two random moments.
Ray, they showed Ray Allen in the crowd, yeah. right? And sitting right next to him was Del Curry. Did you notice
that? Oh, I didn't notice Del was next to him.
Yeah, they showed Ray Allen in the crowd, and he has on like this huge Jesus piece. And right after he got game, and right next to him was Del Curry.
Were they? They wouldn't have been teammates then, right? No, I don't think 99? Del ever played with him.
He would have been with the Bucks at the time, right? I don't know. I'm just assuming that they were teammates, and just because, why else would Del Curry be there? And the other thing that I thought was pretty funny was after Trajan Langdon's travel, they cut to Mike Krzyzewski's wife and his daughter. His daughter was already sobbing. There was 5 seconds left in the game. Like she went full on Adam Morrison.
That's my list as my favorite random moment. She's an adult. She's like 30. She's just in tears. Like not even in tears. She's bawling. And they held that camera on her for a solid 3 seconds. Like shout out that camera guy for being like, no, we're getting our shot at the Krzyzewski family right now.
I mean, I have no problem with the crying, right?
But it was just weird.
It was too early. That game's not over yet. Come on. And she's like, they've won titles. Like the game that's games at that point, too early for tears.
What if Langdon hit a three to tie?
Yeah, exactly. She's crying tears of happiness.
My other favorite random moment, Jim Nantz is talking about the Final Four and goes, we just need to shout out Jim O'Brien and what he did at Ohio State. Just a great story. Yeah, that Final Four got vacated.
It doesn't exist.
So it's like I said it on I think the last podcast where rewatching this, knowing the ending and the outcomes, there are at least one just hilarious miscall. Nantz had like the Marcus Page, like, that's the image of the game. And it's like, just wait a few seconds. This yep. one was him being like, shout out Jim O'Brien. It's like, well, just how about a couple years down the road?
Well, you might have missed on that one.
So
before we get into Jim Nance's tie, we forgot to talk. It's the craft beer cast, bro. We forgot to talk about what we're drinking. What do you got?
I'm sticking with my – I still have a few left of the – I'm on a strict order from my wife of I'm not allowed to get new beer until I finish my beer. So I'm sticking with my I'm sticking with my street side. Who's a good beer?
You know what's funny? My wife has been the exact opposite. Every time I go to the beer store, I'll come back and she'll be like, why is that all you got? I'm like, I literally have like 40 beers right here. And she's like, well, you know, you got to stock up. So just in case anything goes crazy, so we don't have to go back to the store. And I'm like, if you're telling me to buy more beer next time I go, I'm going to buy more beer. The next time we'll come back like a week later with 50 beers. She'll be like, that's all you got? I'm like,
that's what.
What do you want me to do?
That's what am I trying to do here? She's like, you're hitting beer again? I'm like, well, yeah, like I drank last week's. And I'll order enough for like the week, essentially, or a few days. And she's like, why don't you ever just order more? I'm like, wait a minute. What? I'm getting mixed signals here. Like, can I order as many as I want? Or do I need to order what I can?
we're trying. Look, the other problem is like, if I have like 150 beers in the house,
yeah,
then it gets to the point where you are just kind of like you just kind of end up like drinking more because you have more in the house and you know you have more there. But right. if you have like five, you're like, I got to ration this. I got to be right. careful with it.
Right. I'm like, I think I order them on Saturday and Sunday. I'm like, I just need to get to Friday with it. If I have enough, I'm like, I'm going to get aggressive on the Tuesday night. And time doesn't matter anymore. So that's the terrifying thing.
Yeah. So what I have is the I'm back to Cape May. I'm back on the Cape May bandwagon. I got my Cape May Dippas, the Coastal Evacuations. Okay. They're just so good.
They are.
Like they didn't want to sponsor the podcast. They didn't want to sponsor the Instagram feed. So I was off them for a little while, and then I got back because it's just so delicious.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to quit them, and I couldn't do it.
It sure is.
All right. So before we get out of here, Riggs, it's time to give out Jim Nance's tie. I'm going to let you do the honors this time because I think mine's going to be obvious. So I'm going to let you go first.
So my original guys I've now crossed off because my Nance's tie was going to be the Final Four logo because it was just one of the all-time greats. then it was going to be the camera guy that held the shot on Coach K's daughter. We discussed that. You know who I'm going to go with for the Nance's tie? Just fat guys. We had an all-time fat guy game. Like, I forgot how fat Jake Voskal was. He had some nice man boobs bouncing up and down in that t-shirt. You had Khalid El-Amin. You had Elton Brand. It was a great, great fat guy game.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going with Ricky Moore.
He was because so
I actually took this one seriously. He scored 13 points in the first half when UConn was struggling. Got them going at the start of the game. Guarded Trajan Langdon the whole second half. He forced the turnover that led to the Rip Hamilton three that put UConn up by five with 2 minutes left. He forced the travel that gave UConn the ball back up by one with 5 seconds left. I have literally three moments written down where he came out of a scrum with a bunch of guys that were 6'8 and 6'9 with huge defensive rebounds. So I'm giving it to Ricky Moore, Augusta, Georgia, Hazel Street, whipping up on his childhood friend. So,
all right, let's hear your trivia.
These are good ones. So Rip Hamilton was the Big East co-player of the year in 1999. Who was he co-player of the year with?
God.
And if you want a hint, I'll tell you what the university is.
Okay.
Miami.
If
you get this, I'm going to be very, very
I was really nice. Hoping it would have been I was really hoping it would have been St. John's because I felt like that would have been a giveaway. God. Was it Darius Rice there during that time?
No, it wasn't. That's a great guess, though. It was Tim James.
Oh, God. I don't know if I would have ever gotten that one.
I don't think you ever would. That one was tough. So he also became the third two-time Big East Player of the Year at that moment. Can you name the first two before him? You should be able to get these if you think about it.
Patrick Ewing.
Yes. Here's a hint. Lefty. Shooter. White boy. St. John's.
Oh, Chris Mullen.
Yep. So Elton Brand, this is another one. Elton Brand was the third sophomore player of the year, according to the Sporting News. They hadn't given out like the big awards yet, but Sporting News had already announced theirs. And he was the third sophomore national player of the year ever. Sporting News had been giving it out. Can you name the two before him?
Kareem?
Nope. Right program.
Walton.
Walton, yep.
Did Jordan win it as a sophomore?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
So those are those two. All right. And here are the last two, and I'll be very impressed if you can get these. All right. So this was, Duke was a 9.5-point favorite in this game, and it was the biggest upset in terms of spread in title game history. What record did it break?
Ooh, gosh.
If you think about this, you should be able to get them because both of them, in hindsight, when I tell you, if you don't get it, when I tell you, you're going to be like, son of a B. I should have gotten that.
It's not Duke UNLV. It's... So what record... The question is, what game had the previous... largest
There were two of them had the same spread.
Georgetown Villanova.
Yep.
That was minus eight.
Yep, minus eight. The other one was after that.
Kentucky, Arizona?
Nope. You want a hint?
Yeah.
It involves the Miracles.
Kansas, Oklahoma.
Yep, that was minus eight.
That makes sense.
And here's the last one I got for you, Riggs. Since this game happened in 1999, since 2000, what is the biggest spread upset in the national title game? This will be a little bit tough for you to get.
Yeah, I'm trying to like just run through my head the games. UConn... shouldn't have. I don't think it's UConn.
Nope, one. Not UConn. You know what the spread was?
Yeah.
It was 5.5.
Sorry, I'm trying to work backwards here. Not last year. It would have been.
You want another hint?
Yeah.
This didn't happen in the title game. It happened in the semifinals, and it involved the absolute greatest block, or the great, absolute greatest dunk that you'll ever see in Final Four history.
Oh wait, it's a game in the Final Four?
No, it's a title game. But the team that won the title in the Final Four, the semifinal, had the greatest dunk that you'll ever see in Final Four history.
Huh.
You want another hint?
Yeah.
The same guy that had that dunk won the game with a blocked three-pointer.
Oh, Syracuse.
Yep. Remember the Royal Ivy when he tried to take a charge and had the definition of a teabag?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, so Syracuse was a 5.5-point dog against Kansas in 2003. That's,
I guess it makes sense. There hasn't been a it hasn't been a one seed versus a Cinderella or anything like that.
It's also like the idea that Duke was a 9.5-point favorite
against a team
that was never outside of the top five. Like, are you kidding me?
Right. Yeah, that's a little crazy.
That's bonkers. That's crazy, right?
That's
that
insane.
Should never happen.
No, that's insane. It's like, what was the spread in Kentucky, Wisconsin? It had to be like 4, 3.5.
I don't, something like that.
It was under five.
There's no way it was 9.5.
No, that's crazy.
It's baffling to me that that should tell you right there, that should tell you what the perception was entering this game.
Yeah. Yeah.
God. About how good that Duke team was. And the reason I didn't bring that up earlier is because I didn't want to ruin the trivia. But yeah, so that was the 1999 Duke UConn national title game where UConn put themselves on the map and shocked the world, baby.
And
we shocked the world. Riggs, we shocked the world.
And young Bobby Doster had a nice raspberry sorbet float.
Raspberry sorbet, baby. It was the most delicious raspberry sorbet I've ever had in my life, bro. As always, if you've enjoyed what we've heard here, you can hear more over at Riggs Podcast. It is the Fundamentally Sound Podcast. It is available anywhere that you can get these podcasts for absolutely free. After you rate, review, and subscribe to that, please give me 5 stars on this podcast in iTunes and tell us the game that you want to hear us talk about next. We're kind of scrambling a little bit for ideas because, to be honest, both of us have a list of about 25 games that we want to talk about. We're just kind of nerds and losers like that. So help us whittle this down and give us some ideas, give us some pointers, give us some tips, and let us know what you want us to talk about. Until then, Reeves, I think we're going to catch up again on Monday night, man. You take care. You survive this weekend, and tell your wife I said that you need to be able to go get more beer.
Yours too.
I'll talk to you later. Yeah.